Greetings, people of Earth. I'm Matt Duss, a Middle East analyst at the Center for American Progress. I'm joined here on Bogging Heads for the first time by Ben Birnbaum of the Washington Times. How you doing, Ben?
Good. How you doing, Matt?
Doing very well. Glad to have you on.
Thank you.
So we've got a number of issues we want to discuss today relating to the Middle East. The first is Bahrain. Bahrain last week released its independent commission report on the events of earlier this year. Ben, you had a couple of articles on this. I'll go ahead and let you set that up, and then we'll discuss.
Sure. As you know, this is a report that essentially the commission was set up by the king in response to pressures for an international inquiry into the events of February and March, the uprising. And he basically appointed this respected international war crimes prosecutor, Sharif Bassiouni, and four other war crimes prosecutors. And the report came out, I guess it was last week now, and there are a few takeaways. There were the main ones about torture and excessive use of force, which I think we all expected. The one I was most interested in was that Bassiouni found no evidence of the government's longstanding claims that the opposition was linked to Iran or was taking orders from Iran, or that Iran had a direct hand in the protests, which is something that the government has been saying for years. So I think they were a little bit shell-shocked in the government. I don't think they expected the report to be this tough. I think, it's interesting. I was in Bahrain about a week after the report launched, and there was great skepticism among the Shiite opposition, among the Shiites, because they figure that there's no way that this report could be impartial because Bassiouni was essentially working for the king. Mm-hmm. One of the more interesting things that somebody told me was that people believed that the king had appointed Arabs, and I think there was one Iranian, because as this person put it, you can't bribe Europeans. So, nobody was completely happy with the report. Shiites thought it didn't go far enough, but I think mm-hmm. the greatest disappointment was among Sunni supporters of the regime, of the government. And just as an illustration of, where things have gone, I brought back some newspapers from when I was there, some state-run newspapers, and you can see this one. You can see there's a picture of Bassiouni at the bottom, and it says, "Great response," basically quoting him in one of his earlier interviews, talking about the cooperation he was getting from the government. This, of course, upset the opposition greatly. But I think the report maybe surprised a lot of people. They didn't really give him a chance, and I think the question is where we go from here. What do you think?
Right. I mean, we'll get to that, I think, in a second. But first, going back to the Iran issue, I think you, in your article of last week, I think it was, or maybe the week before, where you spoke to the American ambassador from Bahrain,
yes.
The Bahraini ambassador to the U.S., where she said, we didn't have evidence, but we know it's there. You can't touch it or feel it, which I thought was a great quote. Something we'd seen. I think there had been references to Iranian influence, even by members of the Obama administration, if I'm not mistaken, even from Secretary Clinton herself,
and always with very
little evidence, which is interesting because I think a lot of people assumed a lot. Certainly the Iranians used it for propaganda purposes, but actually so did Iraqi Shias who demonstrated, various groups, the Sadrists, but even more mainstream Iraqi Shias, Ayatollah Sistani, and a number of other top Ayatollahs and Najaf released statements against the violence. But I think one of the reasons I'm not surprised to see the lack of evidence of Iranian involvement is that Iran Iran loses when sectarianism is a top-line issue in the Middle East. I mean, it puts a lot of effort into kind of bridging the Shia-Sunni divide as a Shiite-majority country, not to mention a Persian non-Arab country. I mean, it uses various mechanisms to bridge that divide in order to kind of promote its sort of pan-Islamic credentials.
Do you really think that's true? I mean, in Lebanon or in Iraq, I mean, I don't see evidence of that, but I'm curious what you mean by that.
No, I think they certainly form alliances with groups that are Shia. We saw that in Iraq. We saw that, and we see that in Lebanon. But we see, you know, their support for Hamas in Gaza, and mostly in Gaza now. But, you know, as an effort to kind of bridge that divide, but the relationship with Hezbollah, even though Hezbollah is Shia, they are Arab. And the same is true with the various Iraqi groups, the Sadrists and ISKI, with whom Iran has worked to various degrees. So, I mean, the issue, the main thing is here is to, like, create a united front of resistance. You know, Hezbollah does try, you know, is not really known for going out and slaughtering Sunnis. I mean, violence has happened. But the propaganda benefit of the relationship with Hezbollah is to kind of create a pan-Islamic resistance to the West.
Right. I mean, I think it's important to note also that their state media was not just acting as propagandists in the case of Bahrain. I mean, they were all over Libya, all over Egypt, basically all over every single one of these uprisings except for Syria, for obvious reasons. I would say this. I mean, number one, it's not like there's no precedent for Iran helping the Shiite opposition in Bahrain, but everything I've read seems to suggest that that ended in the mid-90s. So it's been quite a while. The other thing I would say is that even though there is no evidence you can touch or feel, the opposition does have something of an Iran problem. I mean, it was very... It's very frustrating to me every time I ask maybe a leader from Wefaq, the main opposition group, you know, do you see any similarities between your struggle and, you know, that of the Green Movement in Iran? And you can't really get them to give you a straight answer. They have a very tough time criticizing Iran publicly. You know, now does that mean that they are Iranian stooges? I don't think so. But even if they were, it really wouldn't matter in the Bahraini context because... The demands of the opposition in Bahrain are really quite minimal in Arab Spring terms. They're not calling for the overthrow of the monarchy. You know, they're calling for things like fairer electoral districts and an empowered parliament.
Right.
You know, and an elected prime minister. So I would say that from an American interest standpoint, it's hard to see how satisfying those demands would harm U.S. interests vis-a-vis the U.S. fleet, the Fifth Fleet, or anything else, because the foreign policy in the end of the day would probably still fall to the monarchy. And it just, I don't see, I mean, if things get out of hand and Wefaq calls for the overthrow of the monarchy, it might be a different story, but it seems to me that we have clear interest.
I think that's right. And it's why I was glad to see that we've held back thus far on this huge arms shipment. I think there was a mistaken report about a month ago that it was going to go forward, and it was greeted rightly, I think, with a lot of anger and sadness. But getting back to the Iran problem, I think we've seen a similar sort of dynamic at work in Iraq, where Shiite groups who are perceived as being much, much closer to Iran have suffered politically. We saw this with Skiri, who renamed himself ISKI, formerly the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a group that was essentially formed among Iraqi exiles in the 1980s that came back, you know, right after the invasion on the heel, and, you know, in the tracks of U.S. tanks. But we also saw that with the Sadrists, who did very, very well, having a much more nationalist message, a much more kind of domestic Iraqi nationalist message, who themselves suffered a little bit when Muqtada went to Iran to kind of escape, you know, some of the attacks he was under. But the Sadrists have still, you know, they still maintain a pretty serious, significant amount of political strength because that message still resonates. The Sadrists, leaders of the Sadrists, stayed in Iraq during the hardest times under Saddam, whereas the leaders of the other party, ISKI, fled to Iran.
Yeah.
But getting to the commission's report, I think I agree. It was nice to see, you know, how far it went and what it said, and it angered both sides, which tells you something. But I think what remains now is, okay, what mechanisms exist to sort of move or implement changes that are clearly needed, and it doesn't seem that there's much there right now.
I mean, I think the key dynamic that, I mean, the one thing that surprised me that when I came there, which I didn't realize from, you know, here in Washington, is that there really was this intra-Sunni and intra-royal family dynamic. It wasn't as if the entire population... The entire Sunni population was four square behind the king. If any, many of them thought that the king, and particularly the crown prince, were too light on the protesters. I remember very vividly There were lots of billboards, and one of them said, no to pardons, and it had a noose, and another one said, expel the Iranian, the foreign agents, or whatever it was, and had pictures of all the main opposition leaders. So it was here, really, that the prime minister, who's been there for 40 years, he's the king's uncle, and more of a hardline figure, he really gained a lot of popularity during the crisis because he was seen very much as a law and order figure. So, and the crown prince, who was holding back channel talks with the Shiite opposition leaders, but was very much weakened. So the question is, can he be strengthened to a point where that dialogue can resume? And on the Shiite side, also you had Wefaq, the main opposition group, and then some of the other ones, wanting to really make a deal, cut a deal, and the protesters on the street being more hardline, you know, calling for the overthrow of the monarchy. So the question is, can the pragmatic players be strengthened to a point where they feel like then they can reach a deal? It would be good if this report could become a pivot point for that, but I think it's too early to tell.
Right. I think Hussein Ibish had a very good report that he wrote for the Henry Jackson Society that actually was released the same day as the commission's report. So it'd be, we could put up a link to that, but I think he made the very good point that, you know, as it is right now, the most extreme factions on either side are being strengthened, and that's a problem. I mean, there isn't really much happening right now that would that would kind of give credibility or strengthen some of the more moderate elements among the Sunnis and among the Shias to kind of come to a deal. So let's pivot here to on the Iran issue to the IAEA report of a few weeks ago. What was your take?
I'm not sure there's much that was new here. I think the fact that it was the IAEA that legitimized some of the Israeli and U.S. intelligence was the main thing. You know, as I understand it, maybe you can speak to this a little bit more, that there were things in here that were really quite old, that before the current IAEA chief was there, that El Baradei did not want to put in there. You know, the question is, what does it mean from an international action standpoint? And I'm not convinced that it means a whole lot. I don't see Russia and China agreeing to any stronger sanctions. I don't know. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I generally agree with that take. I mean, it sharpened some of the conclusions, but on the whole, there was not a lot that was new. I think as we knew, Iran, it still has yet to satisfy the IAEA. The IAEA under Amano now is coming out a bit more strongly saying that. And I think some criticized the Obama administration for their reaction to the report, which I disagree with, probably not surprisingly. I think it's much better for the United States to let the IAEA take the lead here and not be seen as sort of whipping the international community and driving the international community on this.
They're leading from behind.
Whatever term you want to use. Yeah. But I think especially given the past decade and some of the things that were done, I think kind of cultivating a much stronger sense of international consensus and being seen as working within that consensus is going to help. Is the best way forward here, and I see that's what they're doing. As for future, as for more international action, yeah, I think you're right. Russia and China have made clear they're really not interested in another round of UN Security Council, another resolution for more sanctions. But at the same time, we've also seen kind of some of the U.S.'s closer partners, like the U.K., already undertake further measures and pay for it with the attack on their embassy yesterday. But I would kind of differentiate between the two different kinds of sanctions here. There's one group of sanctions that frustrates Iran's ability to obtain equipment that could be used for their nuclear program. And obviously the program continues, so it's not been conclusively successful. However, I don't think there's any doubt that it has slowed the program, caused Iran to just search high and low for where they can find, you know, these different tools. Pieces of equipment to do what they have to do. On the other hand, it has also made them much more creative and sort of, and I've actually heard this from people who are close to the Iranian program, that, you know, it has actually increased their knowledge about the different ways you can do different things. So I think there's been costs and benefits there. But then there's the other group of sanctions that are basically just meant to punish Iran and tighten the, you know, increase pressure to get them back to the table to make some kind of deal. And I think there's a real question after at this point whether that whether there's any amount of pressure that could really make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like they're all in here. I don't see any I hope I'm wrong, any prospect of them coming to some sort of an agreement along the lines of the Tehran Research Reactor deal, but I've been wrong before. What do you think the odds are that, let's say, by the end of next year, that Israel will strike?
Odds, I don't know. I'd probably, you know, it's not zero, obviously. I wouldn't put it at 50%. I'd put it at less than 50%.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe 30%. What about you?
You know, I mean, if you'd asked me 7 months ago when, you know, after Stuxnet and after, you know, it appeared that the, you know, the exploding nuclear scientists, as David Frum likes to call them, and it appeared like the, oh, and then Meir Dagan's prediction, the former head of the Mossad saying that they wouldn't have a nuke until 2015, I thought the day of reckoning had been put off. I think with the recent disclosures about discussions within the Israeli government and it appearing really like Netanyahu and Barak have made up their minds, I think it very well could happen next year. I probably would put the odds at less than 50%, but I read something from Anshel Pfeffer of Haaretz who predicted that we'd see a strike probably in early spring. And his reasoning was, A, that the weather would improve such that a strike would be much more likely to succeed, whatever success means, and also that the American presidential election will have heated up by then, and it will be more difficult for Obama to restrain Israeli action. I think there's another political consideration here relating to the presidential race, which is that at this point, every single Republican presidential candidate except for Ron Paul has essentially promised to bomb Iran if they get elected. So we don't know what the how much time is left on the clock, but it's very possible that if it looks like Obama is going to lose next year, that Barack and Netanyahu might decide to keep their powder dry and maybe hope that come 2013 that the U.S. takes care of this, which has always been their preference.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I don't – it's – on the question of what the candidates have said, I think Newt Gingrich in the most recent debate, or maybe it was the previous foreign policy debate, I think he – seemed to walk away from the bombing Iran option and talked more about sabotage and supporting resistance elements in Iran. And Mitt Romney as well, even though he has voiced support in various ways, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington or the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that was actually somewhat less hawkish than almost the exact same piece that he had written during the 2008 primary. But of course, on that very same day, one of his top advisors, Eric Edelman, published a piece in Foreign Affairs saying we have to bomb Iran. So I guess interpret that however you want. But I mean, in regard to Israel's calculations here, I think you would agree, I think most people would agree that Israel, the problem with an Israeli strike is they can't really finish the job.
Right.
They don't have the resources, the capacity to really keep up the sustained, I mean, we're not talking about hours or days, we're talking about probably weeks of attacks to destroy enough of Iran's program and what is suspected to be Iran's program to kind of justify the blowback that would very likely come. And they really just don't have that ability. So there's the one interpretation is that, well, they would start it understanding that the U.S. would have to step in and finish it, which I think is just cynical in a number of ways. But, you know, they do what they have to. But, I mean, what would they hope to achieve? I mean, how much could they actually set back Iran's program and at what cost? And when I consider those things, it just does not add up for me. I mean, what I often hear is like, okay, it'll set back the program 2 to 3 years, but what could happen within that 2 to 3 years? You know, there could be something great that happens. And to me, that's not really a strategy.
Right. I mean, I think the depressing thing is that the fact that the Green Movement hasn't really shown, or the Iranian opposition, whatever you want to call them, hasn't shown any life. You know, I think in 2009, when it looked like this thing, you know, might just succeed, maybe the calculations might have been different because you figure give it a few years and the regime will collapse. Now that that looks very unlikely, you know, I think they're obviously considering it more seriously. On the question of cost, at what cost, Barak actually came out recently and said that the regional war that would likely result from an Israeli strike would cost fewer than 500 Israeli casualties, which I think is probably very, very optimistic, considering that this would probably be a four-front war involving mm-hmm. not just Iran, but Syria, Hezbollah, mm-hmm. and Hamas and Gaza. But I think the more interesting variable that I really haven't heard anybody talk about is how many Iranian casualties this would cause. And, right. and I say that not just from a moral standpoint, but to me, the blowback is going to depend very much on that number. And I have really no sense of what it would be. You know, the difference between hundreds or thousands of casualties is very different from tens of thousands or even more than 100,000, and I really don't have any idea where it falls. You know, conceivably, if they were able to do this with minimal collateral damage, they would not be condemned by the international community, or at least not the main players. But if they, you know, hit Natanz and uranium goes flying to the sky, and you know, Iranians start getting all sorts of genetic diseases, this could be something that really erodes Israel's legitimacy at a time when they can obviously ill afford it. Do you have any sense of what the estimates are?
I don't, but and I think that's an interesting question, but I don't. I mean, honestly, I don't. Obviously, more dead Iranians would be worse, but I really have a hard time envisioning a situation. I mean, given what we know, how widespread and the program is on purpose, because that's kind of the lesson the Iranians learned from the Oseraq strike in the 1980s, right. was disperse the program, hide it, put it all over the place. I mean, for me, actually, the whole, you know, Iran striking back through various proxies, Hezbollah and others, it's bad enough if that doesn't even happen, in my view. I mean, first of all, the you know, what would likely happen, the absolute, you know, the regime just completely taking its cue to completely just eviscerate what remains of the Green Movement, right. with the support of a huge, probably majority of its population, using it, you know, using that cue to completely consolidate its power, deciding absolutely to pull out of the NPT, because the information used to bomb the sites will have been gotten through its cooperation with the IAEA in large part, and doing all of this with a good measure of international sympathy, given that they just suffered a preventive attack. So all of that happens before you even start talking about, you know, attacks by Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, like you said, it would set back, just from a popular, you know, Iranian public opinion standpoint, would mm-hmm. step back the opposition for many years. So, yeah. you know, those are the variables that I would look at. You know, how many casualties, obviously it's important how many Israeli casualties it would cause, but how many Iranian casualties, how many years could a strike conceivably set the program back? How likely it would be to succeed. So, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
So given that calculation, I mean, say Israel doesn't strike and we live with an Iranian nuclear capability. What does that look like? I mean, I often hear people saying, oh, an Iran with an Iranian nuclear weapons capability or, you know, God forbid, an actual weapon would be emboldened. And, you know, it's rare that I often see people kind of specifically talk about what an emboldened Iran looks like. I mean, we saw an emboldened Iran certainly after the fall of Saddam Hussein. What does that look like if Iran gets that capability now?
I mean, probably more of the same, just even bolder action. I mean, it's possible that Hezbollah might feel freer to act with impunity on the Israeli border, same with Hamas. I mean, maybe it's the proxies that would be freed up to act. I mean,
right,
I really don't know, because I can't get inside the heads of the leadership there. So,
right. I mean, but that's my question. I'm just, you know, I don't think it would mean nothing, but I have to say, I think there's a lot of these claims made. And a lot less actual describing what it looks like. Say, let's use that example of Hezbollah. Say we have another 2006. You know, Hezbollah captures some soldiers. They start launching rockets, which now have a farther reach. And Israel strikes back, as it almost certainly will. Does Iran actually use a nuclear weapon?
Well, what if before they strike, Iran issues a warning that if you even think of going near Beirut or you know, whatever the red lines they set, you know, you will be sorry. I mean, I think it would have a constraining effect on Israeli action. And I really don't, I was not around in, you know, the Cold War days, so, mm-hmm. you know, the whole calculations, is, some of this is beyond me, but, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like if they had a clear nuclear capability and the capability to mm-hmm. deliver it, not just to mm-hmm. Israel, but to Europe and mm-hmm. to the United States, they would right. be able to make a whole lot of threats that they can't right now. And I just don't know how the U.S. would respond if they said, you know, we want your naval forces out of the Persian Gulf, you know, within a week, or we're going to put Washington under threat. You know, I don't think it's nothing.
Yeah, I don't think it's nothing either, but I just have to, you know, I mean, is the threat of Iran, from what we know about Iran's behavior, it's aggressive, but frankly not irrational. They are deeply, deeply concerned with preserving their own regime, which they see as, you know, kind of proof of God's will. Is this regime going to destroy the third holiest site in Islam?
They wouldn't need to. I mean,
right. I mean, but is that a credible threat that this Islamic regime would actually do that?
That they would launch a targeted strike on the greater Tel Aviv area? I mean, Jerusalem is pretty far from Tel Aviv. You know, I don't think they would strike Jerusalem, but I don't mm-hmm. think they would have any compunction under the right circumstances with you know, sending a Shahab 3 missile into the middle of Tel Aviv. So,
knowing that would mean from an Israeli response. Yeah, I just don't. I have a hard time with that.
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that they wouldn't. It's tough to really make predictions about things where, mm-hmm. you know, you have some cognitive dissonance because you obviously mm-hmm. don't want any of these things to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to consider these scenarios. But, you know, I obviously think that it would be catastrophic if they got it. The question is if it would be more catastrophic, the results of a strike. So I guess we'll have to see.
Right. Yeah, I'm just saying if we look at Iran's past behavior, the example that's often brought up is the Iran-Iraq war, when it was mm-hmm. it was an absolute certainty that Iran would never give up. Ayatollah Khomeini said repeatedly, this, we will never give up, we'll never give in, blah, blah, blah. Guess what? The time came, they gave in, they made a calculation. It's not worth destroying this regime over.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So, yeah,
don't
okay,
know.
Well, it's hard
you
to predict.
Do you want to shift to the whole Palestinian unity question now that we have
sure.
Abbas and Mashal meeting recently and talking about holding elections soon and forming a government? I mean, where mm-hmm. do you stand on this whole issue of Palestinian unity?
Well, you know, it's tough, obviously. I don't know what to make of the latest stories, the latest meetings. I'm inclined, given what came of the May reconciliation, which was very, very little, with a lot of fanfare, I'm inclined not to make too much of it. I'm very, very intrigued by the talk of Hamas joining the PLO. It's clear that they've wanted to do that for a while. They want to basically take over the PLO. But if they join, I mean, it's clear that certain elements of Hamas want to join the PLO under a chain, you know, a revised charter that removes the recognition of Israel. But the interesting question is, say they do join the PLO under the charter as it is now, what does that mean for the peace process? Because that would effectively mean that they are accepting the PLO's past commitments, which include recognition of Israel.
I don't see, and I know Carl Vick had a silly piece on Time the other day. I just see no possibility whatsoever that Hamas is ever going to recognize Israel. And I know that because not just because of what's in their charter, but what their leaders say daily. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about them accepting the 67 borders in principle, but you have to look very carefully at what they say. They don't say we will accept, you know, our state on 67 borders and everything beyond, you know, we'll be okay with that being Israel. They really see it as an interim step, you know, and they talk about a long-term truce, but I don't think you're going to ever hear Hamas leaders talk about a lasting peace with Israel. I just don't think that, you know, that sort of religious ideology is as bendable as we'd like to think.
Well, of course, you have the same religious, you know, kind of mirror image ideology on the Israeli side. There are parties that are a member of the Israeli government that
right.
do not recognize a Palestinian state.
Sure.
But Israel as a government, you know, as a state, you know, the current leadership, even though there's questions about the actual Likud party charter, Benjamin Netanyahu has, you know, voiced support for a Palestinian state. So what would it mean for a Palestinian government if you have Hamas, you know, that refuses in principle to recognize these things as, say, Shas does,
right.
but yet, it, you know, abdicates violence? I mean, my question is, go ahead.
Yeah. I think the analogy to the Israeli government is a good one, because I would say that I don't see any possibility that the Israeli government as currently constructed, even if Bibi did decide that he wanted to make the concessions necessary for a deal, I don't think he could do it with Shas and with Lieberman and with I'm blanking on the small settler party. You know, I don't think it's necessary to reach unanimity within a population to reach a deal. I mean, I just for somebody to say to me that Hamas is going to tomorrow recognize Israel, that to me is about as unlikely as the Jewish settlers in Hebron saying tomorrow, you know, okay, it's okay, we're going to move, we're going to accept a Palestinian
right.
state. I just think it's fanciful. So I think the goal needs to be having a strong, you know, strong pragmatic forces on both sides who can have the popular legitimacy to cut a deal and have the willingness to take on the rejectionists on both sides. You know, Israel has shown a willingness to do that. It's questionable whether it can be done on the Palestinian side, but I think given the polling numbers, the recent polling numbers for Hamas, which show them really suffering, it's conceivable that if you hold elections in the near future, that Fatah would keep the presidency and regain the legislature and would then have really the popular mandate to strike a deal if there was one to be struck.
Right. I mean, on that point of strengthening the moderate elements, I mean, you know, just as Hamas and its violence and the violence of other Palestinian extremist factions weaken the kind of peace camp in Israel, have weakened it, you know, almost beyond repair. I hope that's not true, but very, you know, it weakened it to an extraordinary degree, and continue to undercut, you know, efforts at negotiation. I mean, the same happens for the Palestinians. You know, they see these settlements increasing every day. They endure settler violence almost every day in some fashion around the West Bank. And it, you know, and they see this and they look at the years of negotiation under the Oslo principles and they ask, what has it gotten us? So I think, I mean, going to the Palestinian UN effort, I think what it should be understood as was it just a complete vote of no confidence in the U.S.-led process. And frankly, I think the U.S. could have handled it much better, and I think Israel could have handled it much better. Because what was Abbas going to the U.N. for recognition, you know, membership of a for a Palestinian state on the 67 borders? I mean, a two-state
right.
solution. Internationally recognized.
Well, there are two points here. Number one, I would say that the Palestinian refusal to join direct negotiations is not a vote of no confidence in a U.S.-led process. I think it's a vote of no confidence in the Netanyahu government. They look at what they achieved in negotiations with Olmert and Livni, and they just see no prospect that Netanyahu is going to even agree to the concessions that they did. And they were still far apart, particularly on the issue of borders. So they just see there as being no point. On your other point about the UN bid, I think the thing that was always most problematic about the UN bid was the issue of 67 borders. I mean, I think, you know, even Israel wouldn't really have a problem with them being recognized as a state and Netanyahu negotiating with Abbas as a president of a state whose borders had yet to be determined. The problem is that if you have the UN or other countries explicitly recognize the 67 borders when everybody knows that the final agreement is going to require some sort of land swaps, it lessens the willingness of the Palestinians to be flexible on that issue. And frankly, that's the biggest, I mean, one of the big takeaways from these leaks, the Palestine papers about the negotiations, was that on three of the four main issues, on refugees, Jerusalem, and on security, the sides were actually quite close. It was really on the border issue and the settlement issue, which are one issue where they were far apart. The Palestinians wanted a very small land swap. Israel wanted a larger one to keep all the major settlement blocks. So if you say 67 borders, which really would be the Palestinian preference, then, you know, maybe they don't want to have to redraw the borders if the international community is backing them. So that is what I think is the problem.
Right, I understand that. But, I mean, just getting, you know, getting it recognized, I mean, because you still hear people claiming that what the Palestinians really want is a one-state solution, it's a two-state. You know, it's just the first stage in taking back all of Palestine. And it seems to me that getting all of these countries on board to recognize a Palestinian state on the 67 borders and then years from now saying, haha, we were just kidding, it was all a big trick, I mean, that's a bit far-fetched for me.
But that's only if it recognizes maybe some of Israel's plans. Because if you recognize on an international basis all of the Palestinian demands, you know, then what is there left to negotiate? I mean, the whole purpose of negotiations is that the Palestinians would give something up in return for a state on the 67 borders, plus minus. So it seems to me that if you give them that on a silver platter, then what incentive do they have to compromise on the right of return?
No, I mean, again, first of all, I would say, I mean, in terms of what they've been willing to give up, how about, you know, 78% of Palestine? And second, which is a massive concession that almost just doesn't really seem to get any recognition anymore. But also, I mean, if we're talking about what is their incentive to compromise, I would ask the same of Israel. When I read the Palestine papers, what I see is, and again, granted, these were coming from the Palestinian side, the Palestinian Negotiation Support Unit, so we can't treat these as, you know, gospel truth.
Well, they were minutes. I mean, they were pretty particular.
Right. Okay. Good. Fine. I mean, what I'm saying is that you see, you know, serious offers being made and attempts to establish a frame of reference, which is really what has most frustrated the Palestinians, is the refusal of the Israelis to agree to a frame of reference. And the Israelis feeling no pressure at all to kind of grant that to them. Because why? Because they have the complete backing of the so-called broker of the process, which is the United States.
Right. And I think what would have been, I think it was David Makovsky who made the point that, you know, he was for Obama giving the terms of reference on 67 with swaps. He said that the main mistake was not getting the Europeans to, you know, dispense their own tough medicine to the Palestinians on the refugee question. I mean, frankly, I think it would not be a bad thing if the U.S. were forthcoming on, you know, the issue of Jerusalem as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the problem is that if you're getting Israel to agree to what essentially is a concession, I mean, certainly by historical standards, agreeing to a Palestinian state on the equivalent of 100% of the West Bank, there's been huge movement over the past 10 or 11 years. I mean, I remember when Barack, when the initial offers from Camp David leaked out that he was considering 80% withdrawal, that was considered a huge movement. So it's not like the Israelis have not come anywhere. And the reality is, I think that Netanyahu would be willing to accept 67 with swaps. You know, the question is, what does Israel get in return? And it's understandable why the Palestinians don't want to agree to any language on Jewish state, you know, because that would prejudice the refugee issue. But, you know, there has to be something that Netanyahu can then take to his cabinet. And I don't know.
You know, I mean, as a political matter, yes, I agree with you. And that's kind of how perverse this situation is that, you know, we've got the Palestinians recognizing Israel in the early 90s, 93, I think. But now, you know, almost 20 years later, the Israelis are finally in a position to really, okay, we're serious about two states, but it's really, I mean, people keep talking about this closing window. I mean, at what point does this window actually close? And frankly, right. I think we're almost there, if not there already. I mean, when I look at these various maps that are drawn, right. You know, say the Makovsky map, for example, we're looking at, you know, the lowest possible number of settlers being evacuated that we're talking about is between 60 and 80,000. Does that track
yes.
with what you've heard?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's probably a low estimate, frankly.
Yeah, okay, so let's say 80,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw how traumatic removing, 5,000 from Gaza was? 8,000?
8,000, yeah.
8,000?
It was about 10,000 with the northern West Bank ones.
Okay, well, you said, okay, yeah. Say 10,000. I mean, and let's be honest, listen, you know, I'm not a fan of the settlement enterprise, but moving people, breaking up their neighborhoods is traumatic. It's inhumane.
It's an excellent, go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I mean, I want to see, you know, a two-state solution, but I just, imagining what it would, what moving 80,000 people and breaking up those communities and neighborhoods and support networks would mean. I just, and then trying to imagine what sort of political sort of will would have to obtain in Israeli society, what sort of level of confidence in Palestinian cooperation would have to exist. I just have a very, very hard time imagining that.
I think certainly if there were a deal along the lines that everyone knows, I have a hard time believing, I think it was Isaac Herzog who said that it would get 80% approval. I think that's probably a bit high, particularly because of the Jerusalem question. But I have not a hard time believing that a referendum on a two-state deal would probably get upwards of 75% of the Israeli public, certainly when you factor in the Arab vote. The question is, and I remember I met with Danny Dayan, who is the head of the Yesha Council, the settlement body, and I asked him, would you respect a referendum? And the thing he said was, the larger the majority, the greater it will be respected. And he made a big deal in particular, and, obviously some people will find this racist, that it has to be a Jewish majority, that it can't be a 51% majority if it's Arab votes that are putting it over the top. But I think your point about reaching a point of no return is well taken. And particularly when you look at some of the settlement activity in the Jerusalem area, which threatens the viability of at least part of East Jerusalem being a Palestinian capital, and the when you have Jewish Israelis moving into Arab neighborhoods, I mean, that just threatens the whole premise of a demographic division of the city, which is already just extremely difficult. So, I think one idea which I've sort of played around with in my head is, what if the international community were to set up some sort of an evacuation compensation fund along the lines of what's been discussed by left-wing Israeli parties before? And if you do the math, it really would not be that expensive in international terms to create, say, a $30 billion fund that would give, say, a $500,000 payment to any Israeli family living beyond the Green Line or even in more far-flung settlements to move back to Israel.
Putting a deadline on it.
With that?
Putting a deadline on it.
I mean, I think, yeah, you're right. If the day comes and there's over 100,000 people that need to be moved, it's going to be very difficult. I don't know why that hasn't been explored, because it seems to me that a lot of the settlers who moved out there did so because of financial incentives and, could probably be lured back by financial incentives as well. So.
Right. I mean, there are interesting projects going on, like the Blue-White Future project. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's Ami Ayalon, former, I think he was ex-Mossad or Shin Bet, but, just talking about not only coming up with funds to compensate some of these people who are brought back across the Green Line, but kind of starting to develop a narrative, for Israelis to kind of say, okay, listen, the settlements served a purpose at one point. Now it's time for these people to be brought home. And I think that's very, very interesting, and I think it's going to be necessary, but there's a couple things. I mean, one, that's going to be very, very difficult for Palestinians to watch, for Israelis to say, okay, settlers, you served your purpose, a purpose which actually, exacted a lot of hardship on the Palestinians, but now it's time to come home. But now, I see the Palestinians in the same way having to develop their own sort of narrative toward their more extremist factions, saying, okay, violent resistance played a role at one point. Now it's time to stop this for once and for all. And Israelis are not going to like to see that either.
Sure. I mean, I think the bigger question, going back to the Palestine papers, that the biggest thing that I'm looking for on the Palestinian side is when the whole discussion of refugees is finally broached to the public in an honest way. And it really hasn't. And I think if there's one thing that the Palestinian leadership is guilty of, it's really perpetuating this myth that millions are going to return. And I think, especially given that they have committed to putting up any agreement to a referendum, I have a very hard time believing, given what the expectations of the Palestinian public are right now, that you could get 50.1% of the Palestinian public to agree to completely abandon the right of return and agree to, other concessions, which, they weren't expecting on Jerusalem and and settlements. So
right. I mean, we can add that on to. I mean, Bernie Abishai had a really good piece. I think it's in the newest edition of Harper's on the right of return question.
Oh, really?
He does a very good job just exploring that, and he gets to some of that what you've just said. And I think that's correct. But let's add that on to the reasons why I'm very skeptical. You're right. Palestinian leaders, some of them have discussed what's going to have to happen, but you know, not nearly explicit enough terms. But it really kind of gets at my skepticism right now, giving all the pieces that have to move to make this happen, that it will actually happen. And I think when I keep hearing, like, you know, everyone knows what the agreement looks like, that may be true, but that doesn't mean it's around the corner. I mean, the kind of political momentum that would have to be created to get to that agreement, it's just not happening. And at some point, I think we have to start thinking about, okay, what happens if this status quo persists? What does that mean for U.S. policy?
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is that there really is no plan B. I mean, it's almost inconceivable that you would begin talking, but, you know, at the same time, there is a point of no return at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just hope that we haven't reached that or we're not close to reaching it. I don't know what else.
I think on that uplifting note, we can draw this to a close.
Sounds good.
Thanks very much, Ben. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for doing this, Matt.
All right.
Okay.